2808, Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and the Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Dennis L. Mega v. Ronald L. Jensen from Tarrant County, In re. Seahawk Incorporated and others, a petition for writ of mandamus, and Continental Casualty Company v. Marianne Downs from Bexar County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side in each case to present oral arguments. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the clerk. Justice Hankinson is recused in the first cause only. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Vega v. Jensen.
May it please the court, Mr. Scott
Stoll
will present arguments.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Stolle, representing the petitioner Dennis Maggio. In Lozano v. Lozano, this court reinforced two important points about reviewing jury verdicts. First of all, the evidence must be measured against the charge as it is submitted. And secondly, from the circumstantial evidence, the jury is permitted to draw reasonable inferences about the defendant's state of mind. The fraud question in this case inquired about the defendant's state of mind. Did the defendant make a promise of future performance with the intent not to perform as promised?
Mr. Stolle, could you address the jurisdictional point?
Yes, Your Honor. The defendant has paid the actual damages. What's at issue in this part of the appeal is the contract damages. He has paid those contract damages pursuant to a Rule 11 agreement, a binding, unambiguous Rule 11 agreement that says the payment is unconditional. That means there are no strings attached to the payment. The defendant wants this court to attach a string so he can pull that payment back. Unconditional is unambiguous. It means unconditional. There are no conditions attached to the payment. He wants this court to attach a condition, an unstated condition, that would permit him to appeal and get his money back. Now, this is an enforceable Rule 11 agreement. It's not this court's or any court's job to add unstated terms to the agreement.
So you're saying even if this court reversed the Court of Appeals decision, the case, there's no way that he could seek the return of the money under your settlement agreement?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So that's what makes this moot. It's not that he paid the judgment. What makes this moot is he has a binding agreement prohibiting him from seeking any return of the money. That's your point.
He has not paid the entire agreement. He hasn't paid the balance of the interest attorney's fees. But he has paid the portion that he's raising a dispute about, which is the contract damages.
And whatever this court does, he has given up his right to seek the money back.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Do you have a release to that effect or any sort of settlement language that states that?
What states that is the language saying it's an unconditional payment towards satisfaction of the judgment. Satisfaction means payment. Satisfaction means the judgment is paid and wiped out in that part that's being paid.
Does the amount of prejudgment interest that he owes turn on the liability and the underlying liability? In other words, even if he can't get the money back, is it still a live issue because how much the principal amount of the judgment is will determine how much prejudgment interest is owed?
The only part that would affect is that the Court of Appeals took away $1 million, the benefit of the bargain portion of the actual damages. If this court were to add those back in, then there'd be more interest. If this court doesn't add that back in, then the interest would be whatever the Court of Appeals says. Of course, we do have the issue about the Court of Appeals having taken away the prejudgment interest altogether, or most of it.
Why doesn't Highland Church give us some room to look at other factors and
view this case as one of implied duress. There's a lot of money at stake here.
Because you're going to get into satellite litigation over what happened, who said what, and what does the agreement mean. You're going to get involved into a lot of hassles about meaning of language, intent of the parties, parole evidence, who said what to who. And I don't think this court should be going down that road into satellite litigation. In the first place, whether there is actual duress should be a fact question for a jury. We've never had an opportunity for a jury to find whether or not he was under duress that my client caused. The case law about duress talks about the duress being caused by the defendant. Here, all we have is a natural consequence of the judgment. Now, this court has gone down the path before of trying to decide the meaning of language regarding indemnity agreements.
Well, doesn't the federal rule on this issue, isn't that really a better rule? Unless the satisfaction of the judgment, or the agreement under which the judgment is satisfied, unless it's unequivocal from the agreement that this was to end the litigation, the court presupposes that that is not a waiver of the right to appeal the legal issues involved in the underlying litigation.
Well, again, the court's going to get involved in satellite litigation if the presumption is...
How would that happen?
Because if the presumption is that the appeal right was preserved, there's going to be fights over whether or not it was preserved. The presumption,
but that would happen in the appellate process. There'd be no, you wouldn't go out and file a separate lawsuit because the argument has to be resolved before the Court of Appeals makes a decision. And once it makes a decision, the argument's resolved.
But I don't know that an appellate court should be making that fact-finding in the first instance. I think the presumption should be opposite from the federal presumption. The presumption should be that the appeal right was given up unless it's expressly preserved.
Maybe you can persuade me there's logic to that, but surely MEGA would rather have $23 million in his pocket than the opportunity to earn 10% interest for the year or two for the appeal to come through. I mean, I didn't understand that part of the argument, that, gosh, we got $23 million. We would rather not have $23 million on the risk of getting 10% interest from this fella. And so... I don't find that argument persuasive. And the other argument is the legal issues are established in the trial court. You either have error or you don't have error. What's the real problem here in one party saying, hey, I'm sitting here with liability for millions of dollars, running interest at 10% every year. I'll just go ahead. I can afford it. I can even afford the risk that the guy can't give me the money back. But I'll pay it, get that over with, but I still want to write to challenge whether or not the trial court judgment was correct. If they're not correct, then I have the opportunity to get my money back. What's the significant problem with that process?
First of all, Your Honor, Mr. Meisler would not have taken the money if it was subject to a condition.
Well, I have that. I find that unpersuasive that he wouldn't take $23 million on the risk that maybe he'd get an additional $10 million interest. So I just find that unpersuasive.
I submit respectfully, Your Honor, that it's not the appellate court's role to make a fact-finding about that, whether he truly would or would not.
No, you give that as a policy. You simply give that as a policy reason for why the court ought to stick with the, when you pay the judgment, one of the considerations is parties rely on it. And you say, well, yeah, he would have relied on it, and I don't find that as persuasive a policy consideration. He might choose not to, but as a policy consideration, I don't find that persuasive.
Well, the presumption, if you presume that the appeal right was preserved, you're going to get into the quagmire that you got into with indemnity agreements that the court ultimately resolved after years of hassle by saying, we're not going to enforce it unless it's expressly stated that the indemnity applies to your own negligence. We're not going to get into these hassles about interpreting the terms of the agreement. That's what the court should adopt. If the court's going to change the law in this area, that's what the court ought to do. The presumption should be, the burden should be on the defendant to get an express reservation of his right to appeal.
Has the respondent correctly characterized the law in other jurisdictions, for example, New York, Florida, Do you take issue with any of those decisions?
I take issue, yes, Your Honor. I think that the only universal rule drawn from the case law is whether the payment was voluntary or involuntary. The courts are all over the map over what standard you apply to determine whether it's voluntary or involuntary. It may not even be a useful test because you get into all these factors about was there duress, was there not duress, is it duress when it's merely a natural consequence of the judgment that the plaintiff was absolutely not responsible for.
But are there some jurisdictions that hold, in addition to that, you have to have evidence of a compromise or settlement or otherwise voluntariness is not assumed?
Some of the courts follow the presumption that the appeal right is still there, unless the circumstances indicate that the appeal right was somehow relinquished.
And that would include New York, California, Florida?
I think Florida, I couldn't say for sure about New York and California. I can say this, if that court does apply that presumption, the presumption has been overcome here. The Rule 11 agreement shows that the appeal right was relinquished. The Rule 11 agreement says the payment was unconditional and that the payment went toward satisfaction of the judgment. So, under either presumption, MIGA prevails, but I do encourage this court to apply the presumption that the defendant has the burden to get an express reservation, which did not occur. In fact, in this case, the reservation that the defendant wanted was expressly negotiated out of his draft.
Can you go to the merits of the case, just session for brevity on that?
I would love to, Your Honor, on the fraud issue. Under Lozano, you look at all the evidence, the totality of the circumstantial evidence. When you do that, in this case, there is more than enough evidence to support the fraud finding. There's more evidence here than there was in Lozano, where, for example, for some defendants, all you had was the taking the Fifth Amendment, dodging some discovery, and taking down some posters. Here,
what breach of contracts are left that's not also fraud?
Breach of contract that does not have accompanied with it all the factors we had accompanied here, denying the operative promise, attaching unstated conditions to the promise, coercing the defendant, bullying the plaintiff, lying about the effect of the release and whether he's going to deal with the option later, the inconsistent documentation, leaving the option oral, but the release in writing, the gamesmanship he showed at trial by changing strategies at different points about what his defense is, and about on trial all of a sudden coming up with information he didn't have at the time he was deposed 6 months before that. The jury could draw from all that circumstantial evidence the inference, a logical bridge that he didn't intend to perform when he made the contract. Now, there's very few situations that's going to have all of that circumstantial evidence. So, over the years, there's been fraudulent promise cases that have gone either way, but there's many more breach of contract cases in the books than there are fraudulent promise cases. It's simply not true that fraudulent promise is going to usurp the contract cause of action.
But aren't we going to have a fraud claim when there's a dispute over what the terms of the oral agreement are by necessity?
Not necessarily. The court could put some limits on it, as I suggested, for example, that if the dispute over the terms goes to a material term that goes to the heart of the bargain that's tantamount to denying the entire promise, then there could be a fraudulent promise. In one of the cases, for example, that the defendant cites, the Harshire case, it was a simple dispute about whether the contract contained an arbitration term. That didn't go to the heart of the defendant's obligation to perform, so it didn't give rise to a fraudulent promise.
Let me ask you couple of questions. If the jury concludes that there was a binding obligation for these stock options, what happens to your fraud claim? Your fraud claim is premised on there is no binding obligation. There was a misrepresentation about the obligation, and so there's no, implicit in that is then there's not an obligation transferred, but we ought to force the transfer because it was fraudulent. But if the jury concludes there was a binding obligation here, then there's no fraud, is there?
Well, yes, there is. The fraud is not premised on whether the contract was binding. The fraud is premised on whether or not it's binding. He never intended to perform it.
But it doesn't. The intent to perform is not relevant in a breach of contract case, because either the obligation is binding or it's not. I may agree to do something. I may never have any intent to honor that. But if the jury finds that that's a binding contract, then irrespective of what I intended, I'm obligated, and the judgment will be reflected as such, wouldn't it?
The contract would be enforceable, but at the same time, the defendant would have committed the tort of the fraudulent promise.
And so if there was a fraudulent promise, then what would be the nature of the damages, if other than the contract damages? What the contract damages would have been, what other damages?
Well, punitive damages. This state recognizes punitive damages for fraudulent tortious conduct. Plus, the defendant in this case says that tort damages are different from contract damages.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Bob.
Thank you, court.
Donald Falk for Respondent Ronald Jensen, Your Honor. May it please the Court, there are three significant issues in this case. First, Mijah cannot make a fraud case out of this contract claim because there is no evidence that Jensen did not intend to perform the option at the time that he gave it. Indeed, there's no evidence that he did not intend to perform the option any time before Mijah quit. The second issue also concerns the distinction between tort in contract that goes to the timing of the damages calculation. When contract damages are based on the value of the performance, which here is the value of the securities minus the option price, that performance must be valued at the time of the breach. This court has applied that mainstream rule unless the breach of the contract is essentially like a conversion, because payment for performance was made in advance. In that case,
what is the principal value of an option?
The principal value of an option is the ability to purchase stock at a particular time, at a particular price.
And so it would be the profit that you can make on the options, the lucrative sort of betting on the come nature of the options.
Well, the option, what we have here is a failure to exercise the option. He wanted this stock then, so the value of the option is necessarily the difference between the value of the stock at the time you try to exercise and the price of the option.
Well, I guess my point is, it seems like if we were to apply your measure of damages, then what's the incentive for someone who breaches a stock option agreement like this, and it's anticipated the stock's going to go up, what's the incentive for them to perform on the agreement if we do the date of the breach as the measure of damages?
Well, the date of the breach is, as I say, has been in every jurisdiction, including this one, the measure of damages, unless the breaching party retains both the payment and the price. The incentive is $1 million in this case if someone tries to exercise in-the-money options, as the jury found these were basically in-the-money options. The value of the security was more than the option price, at 25 times the option price as it happens. It's the same incentive not to breach any contract. Whether or not a stock will go up in the future is precisely the type of speculative concern that has been excluded from contracts.
But hasn't there been a retention by the employer in this instance? In lieu of wage increases that may be offered to the employee at the time, they're offering these options.
He has an option. Because of that, he has a lawsuit at all. He has the option contract. He did not pay for the stock, and this is a case about a refusal to exercise an option.
Well, did the employee pay for it through continued employment?
He paid for the option, but not for the stock. Under the finding that there was a contract at all, he did pay for the option, the ability to, at a time of his choice, ask for delivery of the stock at the stated price. That is what was breached here.
On the mootness question, I I gave Mr. Stolle a hard time about just, I don't find it persuasive that a person would give up $23 million on the hopes of getting 10% interest during the course of an appeal. But I am troubled by the litigating over how to get the money back. It seems to me a rule that says if you pay the judgment, meaning we've given the money to the other side, you really give up the right to appeal, because all the courts then is deciding the law principle behind it. But in fact, for you to get the money back, you've got to go back to the trial court, maybe initiate a new proceeding, and go after trying to recover the money. There's not a mechanism in the appellate court to direct a party to return money that you voluntarily, unconditionally gave to them. Why shouldn't the court have a bright-line rule that says if you pay the judgment, and that's the only reason you do, is just to pay it, to avoid post-judgment interest or whatever that is, the court just doesn't want to buy itself additional litigation on trying to get it back if we decide the original judgment was wrong.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's the wrong result for a number of reasons. One, it is not outside the bounds of experience in this state or in other states for people to pay judgments without execution and to have to go get them back. In fact, if there's been an execution, there's a whole separate form of action in the code to do that. If there hasn't been an execution, it would seem to me there are two things. Some courts have suggested, rather vaguely, that an order may be had to return the judgment. Here the payment was pursuant to an agreed order. Conceivably, the trial court would have jurisdiction to issue an order that money be repaid. If that violates this court's sense of the proper procedure, at the very least, an action for money had and received could be had here. The principle of that action is that someone, you paid over money at some point, and the person to whom the money has paid does not have the right to it. That seems to cover exactly this position. And yes, there might be some litigation. It seems a rather minor possibility that would be serious litigation here. And I would add that I was just scouring.
No, your position though is that because of the significant difference in what interest you would be charged in the open market based on what the legislature requires to be paid post-judgment is all that it takes to force someone into paying a judgment. Your scenario kind of indicates to me that anybody who's sophisticated financially would opt to pay their, if they got a judgment against them, opt to pay it immediately and then proceed with the appeal because of the difference in the interest rates. So it seemed to me that a rule that would permit one to do that would have substantial risk of increasing litigation over getting judgments returned.
Well, I guess I have two responses to that as well. First, I guess the first basic response is what's wrong with encouraging the payment of judgments? We think, as we said in our brief, that this court should adopt the mainstream view, the view of the federal system and at least the major states, and we believe a majority of the states, but certainly the other large states with a lot of business and a lot of contract litigation, that places the presumption to the effect that payment of a judgment by itself does not moot an appeal unless there is a signs that there's been a compromise or settlement.
But
there
isn't this more than payment by itself? I mean, it was termed unconditional and satisfaction of the judgment, and in fact, the preservation of appeals language was stricken.
Well,
I mean, if we're going to talk about presumptions here, it would seem to work the other way.
Well, let me address, there are three questions in that, and let me address them one at a time. Unconditional, certainly under the voluntariness test, the court's current voluntariness test, unconditional does not mean the same thing as voluntary any more than unconditional surrender is a voluntary surrender. It means that the plaintiff could spend the money. It didn't have to be kept in escrow, nothing else. The plaintiff could spend the money and Mr. Jensen took the risk that he'd be able to get it back. There was no satisfaction given. In fact, Mr. Maja argued strenuously to the trial court that this would not satisfy the judgment, and there's nothing in this agreement that says that any part of any judgment or any claim is satisfied, compromised, or settled.
But wasn't it termed as payment toward satisfaction of the judgment?
Well, it was not a gift, Your Honor. It was certainly connected up with lawsuit and needed to be connected up with this lawsuit. And if a judgment were affirmed, it would satisfy that. But that does not by any means mean that there was any relinquishment of the right to seek return of the money upon a reversal by this court.
It just seems to me that it would be very easy to put in there, this was without prejudice to our right to appeal. And apparently there was some attempt to do that, but that was stricken through. And I don't know how we can read that other than a presumption the other way.
Well, I don't think that should be a presumption either way at all. What happened was that provision essentially said that Meisner would waive his right to bring the argument he brought in this court, waive his right to make the jurisdictional argument. He didn't want to do that. He didn't agree to do that. And the agreement was
to... Is this in the record?
Well, he certainly refused that.
But what you're talking about right now is not in the record.
Well, the terms of the agreement...
About why this was stricken through.
Well, I believe it is in the record before this court, which it is...
There's an affidavit attached to one of the briefs explaining that, isn't that correct?
There's an affidavit attached to the brief, and the fact that Mr. Meisner wouldn't agree to the provision, I think, is I don't think that's under any dispute here.
Now, but the reasons you're giving for why, I didn't see that in the record. Maybe I just missed it.
Well, there's an affidavit to the effect that the parties would not agree to waive their argument. We would not agree to waive our appeal, and so we basically teed up the root jurisdictional issue here.
I understand, but you were giving reasons as to why that was, and I didn't see that in the record.
Well, I certainly did not mean to go beyond the scope of the record. What I thought I was doing was saying that they would not agree. I was trying to explain what the provision, which is in the record, says, which is what essentially made it impossible, would have made it impossible for them to, they would have been stopped from challenging the jurisdiction. And I guess it's simple, and that is in the record. You know, why they did not want to do that is not in the record, but I don't think it's subject to any reasonable dispute.
Can I ask you a question? Your client wants to preserve his appeal based on the issue that the measure of damages in the trial court was incorrect. Is that right?
The measure of contract damages in the trial court and affirmed, yes.
If you win that point, if I understand it, that means that the judgment would be reformed and your client would only owe the $1 million that the jury found as whatever it was and not the profits, because the measure of damage submitted was at the time of trial. Is that correct? And so is the bottom line then, if you prevail, you would get a refund of $22 million.
Roughly.
Roughly, yes.
I mean, there would be prejudgment interest on the $1 million.
Pre and post-judgment. So that's how that works.
You have
to win that point on the measure of damages in order to be entitled to a refund of what you pay.
Absolutely.
And to be able to do that, you have to keep the appeal here.
Absolutely.
Well, what about the other side's cross petition saying that, well, there was fraud and we're entitled to our punitive damages, which would add another, what was it, $46 million or whatever it was, to what would be owed? That issue's still here before us, isn't it, on the punitive damages?
Well, the punitive damages aspect, as punitive damages, has not been passed upon by any court yet and isn't in front of this court. Whether there's a fraud claim is before this court.
Well, but I mean, if there's a fraud claim and the Court of Appeals said there's no evidence of a fraud claim, so no recovery for your opponent, which is fine with you. But he's saying, well, no, there was evidence that we're entitled to get our fraud damages, which include the punitives. So that's a substantial amount of money viewed from his side of the case. Is that true?
There's certainly a substantial amount of money. The only point I was trying to make, Your Honor, was that whether punitive damages were justified under the law has not been passed upon separately and apart from whether there's any fraud claim at all.
Oh,
That's the only point that I was going to clarify. But yes, there is. It's a significant amount of money.
In other jurisdictions where the courts allow the parties to satisfy the judgment and then appeal and get the money back, how is that handled procedurally? Is it through the common law, through rules?
I think it varies across the many states in which it is. It's not something that's litigated very often because it may be litigated if the party is out of money and then the party that took the benefit is out of money. But I think it varies sometimes under the statutory provision. I'm not closely familiar with it, Your Honor, but I believe in some courts it'll just be the trial court will issue an order under its general equitable powers ordering the return of the money. In some courts there'll be a separate action, and in some states I believe there's as there is here for judgment satisfied by execution, there may be a code provision. But I think that varies across the different jurisdictions. On the damages question, the measure this court has applied has been the normal measure. The distinction is not justified here. The distinction has been made in other courts and in this court that if it amounts to a conversion, you get the tort-like remedy. There's no evidence of that here. In fact, in the other courts that apply that, as far as we can tell, this is the only court that in a contract setting, or nearly the only one, even in a tort setting, that allows the damages to run up sort of to the day of trial as opposed to a reasonable time after conversion. In fact, the Texas courts generally apply a much more conservative rule for conversion itself. Here there's no distinction, at least none has been offered, between the reasonable time rule and the time of breach, because the reasonable time rule is usually, almost without exception, doesn't exceed a couple of months. In fact, Mr. Maisha testified on his last piece of testimony, page 92 of the sixth volume of the record, that he didn't know anything that would change the value of the company until at March, at least several months after the breach. I don't know that there's anything really to add on the fraud claim beyond what the court said. I'm happy to answer any questions on it. I think the really basic concern here is whether a dispute over a term, a dispute that doesn't arise until quite a bit later, or isn't manifest at least until quite a bit later, is enough to suggest that the optionor did not intend to perform the contract at the time the contract was entered into. I think that cannot. There is no limiting principle that Mr. Maisha has suggested, apart from the sort of rules this court has applied, where someone says contemporaneously or nearly contemporaneously that I sure don't intend to perform that part of the contract. Certainly, even if that were significant, the limits placed on the option, according to Mr. Jensen's testimony, did not render it a nullity or render it worthless. There would be no difference if Maisha had remained employed, and indeed the option was designed to reward loyalty. And even under the strictest view, if you try, he would still have made about 50% on his money, which isn't bad for a day's work.
Mr. Falk, you suggest that if the date of the breach is not when you assess the value, say certainly within a reasonable period of time, what would you suggest would be the elements for determining reasonableness? We have a difficult time because for us reasonableness necessarily implicates some sort of jury findings about whether it was reasonable. What elements would you instruct a jury as to what was a reasonable period of time when exercising a stock option?
Well, to begin with, I don't think the reasonable time measure is appropriate here because the conversion measure isn't appropriate because the stock wasn't paid for in advance. But to answer the question, if it were appropriate, usually a reasonable time is when it's been applied it usually has to do with there may be some restrictions on the stock that have to come off. There may be some characteristics of the market that are particularly odd here. It would be a private transaction, so it might be a couple of months. Of course, the court, the courts of Texas and every other state deal with some frequency in cases involving private stock, family disputes or other disputes between people who own pieces of private companies. And then, as far as a contract setting, at least, it's always just been the time of the breach, even though, of course, in reality, it takes more than a nanosecond to dispose of stock of that kind. That's why I think the time of the breach is a perfectly acceptable measure here, especially since the valuation of a private security is going to be proved up through testimony, either as to bona fide offers or to intrinsic value and so on and so forth, which does not depend so much on the fluctuations within a few days of the market. One example is if someone has a massive amount of stock in a thinly traded company, it may be unreasonable to suggest that they could have sold it all in one day. But here you'd be looking at a private transaction if a reasonable time were to be incurred.
Let me ask you that. In a circumstance like this where the breach occurs at the same time the option is attempted to be exercised and there's a recognized market, there's a price for the option and there's a recognized market value for the option, it seems to me that's one argument for saying in this case that ought to apply. But it seems to me there's some authority out there indicating that that isn't necessarily always the case in, say, when somebody anticipatorily repudiates the option and there's no immediate market. Is there any indication in the authorities out there that the reasonableness test is a test that's used when the circumstances of a breach contemporaneous with the effort to exercise and recognize market doesn't exist? Is there some notion that that is a substitute when certain factors don't exist, or is it an independent decision by the court?
Well, most courts do not even apply a reasonableness test unless you are in a conversion-like situation. But those that do, you can repack. You can look at the question one of two ways. And the sorts of situations you're talking about often, there's something that is restricting the accomplishment of performance, particularly if it's an anticipatory breach. Some of the cases that were cited on both sides, for example, involve warrants or other agreements that would require the breaching party to register the security. That process takes some months, then the stock would be issued, and only then would the non-breaching party have the ability to realize his profit, the benefit of his bargain, so that if the breach was in November, ask for the exercise or the conversion, whatever, of stock or whatever it might have been in November, but there was no way, had the performance been made, that it would have been due and complete until March, then courts have generally said March is the time to value it. So I think the answer to your question is yes, but for the most part, in those situations, you can also reframe the question as when the performance is due and when the breach really affects the breaching.
Mr. Falkenton, I understand that the value was submitted to the jury at the time of trial.
Well, a number of values were submitted to the jury, but it is undisputed and indisputable that the jury arrived at its so-called lost profits figure by multiplying the number of shares by the price right before trial, the most recent price introduced into evidence.
But and you're arguing for value at the time of the breach as
correct.
The measure. Well, would you have made that argument if this case was tried in January of this year, when I understand the stock was worth a nickel?
Well, the prevailing rule, the rule that the mainstream and the bedrock rule that this court has always adhered to has been the time of the breach. So the argument that, and you know, all courts have been, even those that permit a reasonable time after the breach have allowed the plaintiff, unless there's some other limitation on the ability to sell the material, the commodity, or the security, they've allowed the plaintiff to get the highest price within the reasonable time. So that, I mean, I don't think that we would have had a leg to stand on. If we agree with the courts that have said that if you're going to let the plaintiff get the benefit of this years of run-up, then the defendant ought to get the benefit too. But the rule has been and should remain that it's at the time of the breach. That's what's foreseeable. That's when people are deciding what to do with the contract, when to enter into it, when to break it. And this court has generally recognized that it's permissible to break contracts without being subjected to tort-like remedies. You have to look at what people were thinking of, what people were looking at the time. And at that time, the time of the breach, that value takes into account what happens in the future. It's what best guess people have at that time. And that's the measure.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
One point on the mootness issue. I think the defendant's argument illustrates why this court should not go down the path of trying to decipher ambiguous agreements and should require an explicit reservation. The defendant wants you to parse the word unconditional and say, well, it means this or it means that. It doesn't mean totally unconditional. It's kind of like the defendant is saying it depends on what the meaning of is. I urge this court not to go down that path. On the fraud issue, many courts, including this court, have said that breach of the promise plus denial of the promise is sufficient to constitute evidence to support a fraud finding. Now, in every case like this, there's going to be a failure to perform. So what tips it over the edge in that circumstance is denial of the promise. If a logical bridge can be drawn between denial of the promise and the inference that the defendant didn't intend to perform, then
that's
logical...
I'm having trouble, counsel. I mean, you have to prove in this theory that at the time the promise was made, there was never an intent to perform. So how is now a subsequent denial of the promise evidence of intent at the time?
Courts have said in many cases, including this court, that denial of the promise is post-contract circumstantial evidence that bears on what his intent was at the time of contracting. That the logical bridge can be drawn, that inference can be drawn, there is a connection. Now, if that is the case, then certainly that bridge can be drawn, that connection can be made with respect to the other circumstantial evidence that was offered in this case. And courts have recognized that the other circumstantial evidence, I've categorized it, those categories of evidence are sufficient for the jury to draw the inference. In this kind of type of case, you have
But can't you draw the inference the other way? Wasn't there evidence here where another employee was offered the options, other family members were offered the options, they received the options? So why isn't this evidence of just a mere employer's discontent that their valued employee decided to leave and now post-events, he's become upset with the employee and has decided not to fulfill the terms of the option.
That was an inference the jury could have drawn, but they chose not to. They chose to draw the inference that he didn't intend to perform. They had the opportunity to see the man testify. They had the chance to look him in the eye and decide that they didn't believe him. They had the chance to decide they believed Mr. Maja, that Mr. Maja was bullied, that he was coerced, that he was lied to. And the jury had the opportunity to infer from all of that conduct this man never intended to perform. This isn't merely deciding not to perform later on. So I submit that logical bridge can be drawn. In a case like this, you have to rely on post-contract conduct. The defendant never signs a contract as he's saying, I'm not going to perform. You have to rely on later evidence to infer what he intended at the time. That's the only way this kind of claim can be proven. And this court has recognized for nearly 150 years that fraudulent promise is a legitimate cause of action in Texas. Regarding the damages question, the defendant is asking for an unprecedented ruling. He's asking this court to hold that consequential damages are simply not available. This court has said many times that direct damages are one measure, but if the plaintiff isn't made whole, consequential damages are also available if they're proven and found by the jury. He wants to tell this court that Mr. Maja doesn't get any consequential damages.
When you're talking about consequential, you're talking about the lost profits.
Yes, Your Honor. And leaving out the consequential damages means that basically the law is presuming a forced sale at the time of the breach. The law is presuming that Mr. Maja was forced to sell at the time of the breach, and that's all he gets.
The difficulty with your argument seems to me to be that if the stock had gone to zero eventually, you would still say, well, we get the breach. We get the damages as of the breach. We just don't get anything after that. So it's sort of a one-way ratchet. You get something no matter what, and maybe you get a whole lot more.
That's always the case. The plaintiff can get the direct damages as a matter of law. He can choose whether or not he wants to seek consequential damages. If the consequential damages are zero or go negative, he simply elects not to go after them, because he still gets his direct damages.
But isn't it their prerequisite for either lost profits or consequential damages is they've got to be reasonably foreseeable, and by definition, stock of this type is volatile in value, and there's just no way of knowing whether it's going to go up or down.
Nobody has a crystal.
When you're talking about consequential, you're talking about the lost profits.
Yes, Your Honor. And leaving out the consequential damages means that basically the law is presuming a forced sale at the time of the breach. The law is presuming that Mr. Maja was forced to sell at the time of the breach, and that's all he gets.
The difficulty with your argument seems to me to be that if the stock had gone to zero eventually, you would still say, well, we get the breach. We get the damages as of the breach. We just don't get anything after that. So it's sort of a one-way ratchet. You get something no matter what, and maybe you get a whole lot more.
That's always the case. The plaintiff can get the direct damages as a matter of law. He can choose whether or not he wants to seek consequential damages. If the consequential damages are zero or go negative, he can simply elect not to go after them, because he still gets his direct damages.
But isn't it their prerequisite for either lost profits or consequential damages is they've got to be reasonably foreseeable, and by definition, stock of this type is volatile in value, and there's just no way of knowing whether it's going to go up or down.
Nobody has a crystal ball, but it was reasonably foreseeable to Jensen that the price, the stock would go up. That's why he bought the company. That's why he gave the options to Maja. That's why he gave the options to his children. He reasonably expected the price would go up. Now, his expectation proved to be true.
But now it's gone down.
If you believe the extra record evidence.
But stock by its very nature is a risky enterprise. Very few people would say, I bet the company that this stock is going to go up. I mean, it is a risk.
It fluctuates, but the test is whether the damages themselves, the fact the damages occur, is reasonably foreseeable, not the amount. You don't have to reasonably foresee the amount.
Now, is there any other authority out there that would measure the damages as of the time of trial for a stock option?
Well, there are cases I cited in the brief, I can't tell you off the top of my head, where courts have applied either the random measure, the highest intermediate value, or the value of trial. But again, the measure you're proposing there, Your Honor, is not what the court submitted. The court submitted lost profits, and the jury was entitled to find that his paper profit was the amount, the value of the stock at the time of trial.
Any other questions?
Did you sue for specific performance?
That was one of the claims originally.
What was that drop before trial?
I'm not clear on what happened, if it was dropped or if it was somehow dismissed by the court.
Because it seems on a theory of specific performance for the breach, under that theory, then they would be required to perform by giving you the options at the day of trial.
If specific performance was granted, that's right.
And at the day of trial, they would have been worth the amount the jury awarded.
That's correct. That's.
I'm a little bit puzzled why specific performance wasn't pursued.
Well, that's the disconnect between the defendant's desire only to limit to the value of the trial, whereas specific performance would clearly give the value later. But the defendant took the position that specific performance was not available because it's not generally available when damages are available.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause.